You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Ask the Lawyer program. Joe Martinello in studio. Today from the Radio Maria studios in Toronto, we have with us today another lawyer, Vince DeAngelis. Vince, welcome to Radio Maria.
Thank you, Joe.
So we're going to be discussing today where you've often in the English language programs that we've been doing, we've talked a lot about immigration, citizenship, and we talked about how we're trying to expand the legal themes for the interest of all of our listeners. And today's program is going to be concerning wills and estate planning, powers of attorney, those kinds of things. And so we'd like to remind everyone that we encourage anyone who has a question relating to our area that we're going to be interested in discussing today, we encourage you to call in and ask questions. There's no question that's too stupid, and you don't have to be embarrassed. We're very happy because by asking questions, sometimes you actually ask the questions that people are sometimes afraid to answer. And knowledge is power, so it's good to be able to share information with you and between you. So the phone number to call in English is area code 416, and the phone number is 245-1534. Again, area code 416-245-1534. So we're going to move on now in terms of talking about wills, powers of attorney, estate planning, but we're going to do some real basic questions. I'm going to ask Vince. I'm going to put him on the spot. We live in a country called Canada. We have a federal constitution. So if I'm dealing with things like wills and powers of attorney, is the law the same everywhere in Canada, or is it different in different parts of Canada?
Well, generally, the law is similar in most provinces. As you know, Canada is a federation, and we have nine provinces and which are under common law jurisdiction, and Quebec, which is civil law, has its own succession regime. So there is a substantial difference, I would say, between Quebec and the other provinces. But throughout the common law provinces in Canada, the laws are more or less similar. There are some differences, especially in BC, when it comes to certain issues with respect to, you know, the validity of wills and how they're signed and whether or not they're signed and whether it can be valid. They have laws that are a bit more forgiving, if you will, whereas the other provinces are more in keeping with the more strict requirements of formality in terms of signing and witnessing wills.
So constitutionally, wills and so on are governed more by provincial law than by federal law. Is that correct?
That's right.
And that would be true for powers of attorney?
Yes.
But maybe on areas of taxation and other things that would be both federal and provincial.
Exactly. So, for example, in Canada, we have the Income Tax Act, which would deal with taxation of death, you know, payment on the value of property that's owned by the deceased. There's obviously the province has its share of taxes as well. And also there's something that's called colloquially or commonly known as probate fees.
Right. That would be estate administration, I guess, in the modern jargon, would it?
The estate administration tax, which is basically a court fee, if you will, that's payable when the will needs to be certified by the courts or probated, if you will. And that's provincial.
And so we sort of have a constitutional background to how it works. So here we are, because we're broadcasting from Ontario, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of people who are listening to us would wonder, well, you know, if there's a law in Ontario that says that when I die, my estate goes to my wife and my kids or my brothers or my sisters or whatever it says, why do you even need a will? Like, I mean, everything's already determined. And we see this a lot, this kind of question asked by a lot of European clients, because as you mentioned, in Quebec, which follows the Napoleonic Code, the European role model, there's what we call a system of forced heirship. So, but we know under the common law there also is if there's no will. So some people say, well, why do we even need a will? Well, how do you deal with a question like that?
Well, without giving too much of a technical response, there's, I would see two main reasons. One, dealing with procedure or formality of wills or succession, and one, substantive. So procedurally, if there is a will, then the executor, the person that you appoint or the testator appoints to administer his or her estate, obtains his or her authority from the will. When you have an intestacy, you're really relying on the court to grant that authority, and there's consequences to that in terms of the choice of executors, and there's a certain pecking order in terms of who has the entitlement to be appointed or applied to the court to be appointed as the estate trustee without a will, or administrator is the old terminology. And so typically it's the spouse or common law spouse and then the children. And so you lose the choice to have choice of the person you want to administer your will if or your estate if you don't have a will in place. The nice thing about a will is that you can appoint one person or alternates. And so it's a much more, I would say, less expensive and quicker way. And in some circumstances, if you plan things correctly, you may avoid the need to have a court probate the will altogether.
Right.
Secondly, there's the issue of, and it's related to procedure, and that's bonding requirements. In Ontario, where a person dies without a will, the applicant has to basically post a bond equal to twice the value of the estate. Now, they can apply for a waiver of that, but that's a separate application. It's at the discretion of the courts. So that can be very expensive.
Applying for a bond can be very expensive because you probably have to have assets to, right, to back up the bond being issued or...
Exactly, and there's a premium to pay as well, and it's like an insurance policy, and it has to be renewed, and depending on the value of the estate, you know, the premium is adjusted accordingly. So that's another, I would say, drawback. Substantively speaking, if you're comfortable with, I mean, Ontario, we have what's called rules of intestacy, which basically follows a table of consanguinity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And putting it very simply, if you have heirs, your estate is basically distributed subject to spousal rights between your spouse and the heir. So if you survive with the surviving, if you pass away with the surviving spouse, the surviving spouse gets what's called a preferential share of $200,000.
Yeah. That's $200,000 amount. So the first $200,000
right off the top
goes to your spouse.
Exactly. Right. And then the balance, depending on the number of issue or children, if you will,
right,
is divided accordingly. So if you were to pass away with one spouse and one child, the spouse and child would inherit one half of the remainder of the estate after the preferential share is paid to the spouse.
If you have two or three children, how does it break down?
Then it's always going to be one, I believe one half to the spouse and the balance to the children.
To the children.
So it basically is, and that doesn't change. So again, and you also lose a lot of the opportunities in terms of planning because you basically aren't able, for instance, to give away assets to charities. So if you wanted to leave something to the church, let's say,
yes,
you'd lose that opportunity. So
right, you'd have to think about it ahead of time. So
actually, I should go back on the intestacy. So if you have a spouse and more than one child, it would be one third. The spouse,
right,
and two-thirds to the children, no matter how many you have. And if you had surviving grandchildren, it would basically come out of that deceased child's share. So one-third, two-thirds if you have more than one child.
So for example, if you had two kids, and of course, depending on the circumstances, and you don't have a will, maybe a third of the estate would go equally between your spouse and the kids, which you, as you said, you may or may not want, depending on the circumstances.
Exactly.
Especially maybe if a spouse would need a part of your estate to carry on and raise the family and so on and so forth. So that's good. So that shows the substantive and the procedural thing. The same question one could ask, because we know that the besides the will, there's also these things called powers of attorney, which has existed for a long time. people used to use them, as you know, for property. And now, fairly recently, the government of Ontario also provided for personal care power of attorneys, as they're called. Now, the question oftentimes gets asked again by people, perhaps who are listening for the first time, or they're younger people in particular, and they, you know, they think they're invincible, they'll never pass away or never get injured. So what do you see as the benefit of having both a power of attorney for property and a power of attorney for personal care? And does it make any difference? Once again, does the law provide who can take care of my property or of myself if something happens to me?
I would argue that powers of attorney are equally as important, if not more important, in will. I think we've had this discussion before.
Yes, I agree with you.
The benefit,
but for the people who are listening, because they would wonder, you know, because a lot of times people say, oh yeah, this is, you know, here are the lawyers, you know, they're drumming up business for themselves and wills, powers of attorney. Gosh, I mean, do we have to spend all this money on legal fees and so on and so forth? So the wills we've understood, but power of attorney. So on the two powers of attorney, what can you say to people who are a little bit skeptical about that? Or what's the real benefit again?
Okay, so the benefits are twofold. Again, it's a much quicker process to have somebody to take charge of your financial and personal affairs.
You mean I don't have to go to court, do I?
Well, there's a longer process. Let's say, first of all, what are powers of attorney? They basically allow you to appoint whom you want to manage your property and personal affairs, should you become incapable of doing so. And there's certain tests for that in Ontario. So with a power of attorney for property, you can appoint one or more attorneys, one or more alternate attorneys. The key thing is you want to appoint somebody that you can trust to manage your financial affairs, and somebody who's capable of doing so and who's willing to do so. And this could be for a very short period of time or for a very long period of time. With an estate, if it's fairly simple, within a year or so, it can be wrapped up. Powers of attorney can last for decades.
Right.
And the same with personal care. You may have certain beliefs. You may, for instance, not want to be maintained on life support. So you may put a direction in your power of attorney for personal care, indicating that you don't want your life maintained by artificial means when there's no reasonable prospect of recovering from that illness.
And that would be for, I guess, is so people can understand, because medical doctors under the Hippocratic Oath, they have an obligation to keep us all alive, right? They don't have an obligation certainly not to kill us, but they have an obligation to try to keep us alive through all possible means.
Exactly. And by the flip side, there could be occasions where, for economic or other means, and perhaps I'm being skeptical, that the physician may decide that there's no reasonable prospect of recovery and that life support should be withdrawn.
Right.
And then you have a battle with the family and the doctors in the hospital. And so you may want to put, again, the nice thing about having a power of attorney, be it property or personal care, is that you can put your wishes in that document in advance so that those wishes hopefully will be respected, but at least you have something there. The attorney has an obligation to act in your best interest, whether it's property or personal care. But with personal care, the attorney has to also act in the interest based on your prior expressed wishes. So even if they're not written down, they have to respect those. Nevertheless, if you do write those wishes down in the document, that gives you further proof of what, you know, your intentions were.
Well, we also hear that, I was interested in what you said, you have to have somebody you can trust. And it's not necessarily the case, though, is it? Because there are two kinds of powers of attorney. They're usually not in the same document. So, for example, I might think that my brother is really smart in terms of handling financial matters, and I would appoint him as my power of attorney for my property. But maybe I don't think he's maybe as interested in me personally as maybe my sister would be, and I would make her the power of attorney for personal care. So do you see that? Does this give people also some flexibility, or have you seen people ever discuss this kind of issues?
That's very, very good point, especially when you're dealing with business owners or professionals. They may actually have two powers of attorneys. You know, for doctors and lawyers may have one to deal with their practice and then one to deal with their personal financial affairs. So that is very important. The more complex the donor, which which is the person giving the power of attorney, the more complex their financial or affairs are, then the more likely they may end up picking somebody different to manage those affairs, especially when you have clients with spouses or more elderly clients who may have children with different backgrounds. And I find that for whatever reason, whether it's capacity or unwillingness to act, they may not want certain children to be their attorneys for property, but right. may want them as their powers of attorneys for personal care.
So this is all part, I guess, of our general tendency in the common law to have to give the person wide-ranging abilities and authority to somebody else to act on their behalf, just like in the wills. We oftentimes talk about testamentary freedom in contradistinction to the European system, and we also have the same situation with powers of attorney. So the question of trust becomes important, as you said. How do you answer, and I just wanted to maybe, because I'm sure there are people listening to us, young and old alike, because younger people may in fact be the beneficiaries of a power of attorney from their parents, for example, who are quite older. We may have older people listening to us wondering about this question of trust. And I've often heard this from European clients. They're always a little bit concerned or skeptical because they're afraid by giving, for example, the power of attorney to their kids, that they're going to throw them in a nursing home in some horrible place and sell all their properties and take all their monies. How do you assure somebody of that kind of a situation, or what can you do to maybe deal with that kind of attitude that you might see from a client?
Well, again, it comes down to a matter of choice, and the benefit of having a power of attorney in place, you get to make that choice, whereas if you don't, there's a whole process, a very expensive process, which we can get into. But
So what you're saying, we'll come back to that. So what you're saying is that, for example, if I don't have a power of attorney for my property and for my personal care, that the government will come into this?
Not necessarily. What happens in that case is there's a government agency called the Public Guardian Trustee, which basically becomes what is known as the statutory guardian of the property, person's property, to deal with property, and also the person. But focusing on property, they become the statutory power of attorney or a guardian of the property. And so an interested family member typically can apply. It's not a court process. It's not necessary to apply to a judge, but they can apply to the public guardian trustee to be appointed in their place as the guardian of the person's property. And they still will be the statutory guardian of the person's property. They won't be court appointed. It's simply an application to the public guardian trustee. It's user-friendly. You don't need a lawyer.
Okay, that's good, because people are always concerned that, it'll cost many, many thousands of dollars every time you go to court.
Well, there is what's called the bond. And again, if you right. apply to be appointed as the person's guardian, statutory guardian of the property, it'd be necessary to post a bond equal to twice the value of the estate. And the attorney has to file what's called a management plan every year. And there's financial accounting with the public guardian trustee. So there's a lot more government oversight if you're actually appointed pursuant to the what's called the Substitute Decisions Act, which has a mechanism for the appointment of a guardian of the property. So it is more cumbersome, I think, and more expensive in the long run. And coming back to the issue of trust and capacity, yes, there's a bond and so forth, and yes, the attorneys have to act in the best interests
right.
of the donor. But if you want that peace of mind, going back to your question of concerns, then what you can do is perhaps appoint somebody you trust, or appoint more than one child, or appoint maybe a disinterested person like a lawyer or an accountant, or maybe a trust company.
Right.
There is a cost.
There's a cost, but maybe.
But if that is a concern, and yet at the same time you do want that child to have some input, then you can appoint them with another one or more parties.
Good. Okay, so that's that gives people some thought. We're gonna break for a minute, and we want to remind people again, if they have any questions or concerns or issues they'd like us to address on this segment relating to wills, powers of attorney, and estate planning, you can call us at area code 416-245-1530. 3:4. Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello with Vince DeAngelis in studio at Radio Maria, discussing wills, powers of attorney, and estate planning. Once again, if you have any questions or concerns you'd like us to address, please do call in at 416-245-1534. So, Vince, we were talking about wills and powers of attorney and just some of the very basic issues relating to what we have in terms of constitutionally and on a very basic level. So now we know, you know, that there's wills and powers of attorneys that are available for people, but and powers of attorney have to be in writing, of course. Do wills also have to be in writing? And what's required in order to create a will? Because, you know, without mentioning any retailers, you know, people may be going to their local supermarket or whatever, they're going there and then they see these wills forms and all these sort of prepared packages and so on and so forth. But what is a will? What do you have to do to actually create a will in Ontario for it to be valid?
Well, a will has to be in writing, and it has to be signed at the end by the testator. Now, there's two types of wills. We have, you know, the conventional will that we think of, and holographic wills. So in most cases, the wills have to be signed by the testator at the end in the presence of two witnesses. So we have that requirement, and there have been a lot of cases where people haven't followed that strict requirement.
So in other words, if I'm an economic person or a cheapskate, some people might say, but I'll call him economic. Joe Martinello, the economic guy, says, I don't need to go to Vince DeAngelis. Our lawyer is going to want, you know, $500-$600 to do up my will or something like that. I'm just going to do it myself. And I'm a real smart guy because I know how to use my computer. So I just type it on my computer and sign it at the end. Is that going to be okay, or is there a problem with that?
Well, that won't be okay. You can have what's called a holographic will, which can be signed by the testator alone. but it has to be in that person's handwriting.
So under the holograph will, it has to be completely in my handwriting.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Because I like to use a computer and you can't, it's not correct, I would have to write it out by hand. Is that correct?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
And do I have to date my will or can I just...
Yes, it has to be dated
as well.
Has to
be dated?
Yes.
And do I have to have any witnesses or not?
Well, again, in if it's a holographic will, you don't need a witness. And with the ordinary will, you do need two witnesses.
So let's say I write out this thing for whatever reason in my own handwriting. So is it easy to deal with that kind of a will if I pass away, or does it present any particular problems in your experience?
Well, again, without the benefit of having a lawyer advise you, there are a lot of issues that can come up. A lot of people, what they do, even with properly prepared wills, they'll go back and they'll make changes and initial them and think that that's a valid change. And so that creates a lot of problems. If you prepare your own will, I only recommend that to be done only in cases of emergencies because
right.
a lot of things can go wrong. Again, you know, sometimes people may not think about choosing an alternative executor in case that first one is not available to act for whatever reason. And also,
are there concerns a lot of times that a person, especially maybe an elderly person, if they wrote something, if not only did they know what they were doing, but how do we really know it's their own handwriting? Does that create any problems?
Well, again, it's an evidentiary issue. You'd have to get handwriting experts and so forth. And, you know, then you get into issues of capacity, which also applies with wills that were prepared by lawyers even. But at least with a lawyer, capacity is a legal test, and the lawyer would have to satisfy him or herself with or without the benefit of a medical opinion as to whether the person has capacity and that they're signing their will. Under their own free will and not under any pressure. But with holographic wills, a lot of times people will forget to distribute certain assets. They may forget or miss an asset.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have that clause that deals with all of the remaining assets that they own in the estate. And if that happens, you're into the intestacy rules we talked about earlier.
Right.
So one of the problems I find, and one of the major issues I have to tackle with clients is ensuring that they know what property they own, and also that they actually own that property. It's not owned through a third party, or it's not, for instance, a corporate property that they own the shares in the corporation, but they don't actually own the property. So a lot of times people don't appreciate the legal ownership or what the consequences of that ownership is, and may not reflect that in their own handwritten will.
So you just raised a very good point, because the world, unfortunately, has become a lot more complicated, notwithstanding what a lot of people would like to believe. So a lawyer can be a very valuable resource and tool. And I'm just thinking now, because I had this experience myself this week, where I realized that, and this is true of any educational forum, much like this radio broadcast, that as lawyers, we are held to a very high standard, right, in terms of what we know and how we advise clients. And in this particular case, I found myself this week explaining or reiterating to a client how important it was to exactly know their entire situation. Like, I'm sure you've had it. Some guy comes into your office and says, Mr. DeAngelis, I want you to leave everything that I own, you know, to my son. I don't care about anybody else, and just follow my instructions and do what I tell you to do, and that's it, and you know nothing about him. And when you get a client like that, or a person who can be very adamant, I have to always remind clients, and I guess for our listeners, that they should be aware, and Vince, if you agree with me, that as lawyers, we have an obligation to know our client. We call it the Know Our Client Rules. And the Law Society requires us lawyers, and we have liability insurance if we screw up and are negligent, but we have an obligation to know our clients and to ask the questions to the clients about their assets and their family situation. This past week, I had a situation where the lady said, "Mr. Martin, I said, can I ask you why you're asking me all these questions about my family?" Well, there was a particular reason specific to it. And I think her emotional undertone was that it was sort of like a gratuitous exercise, which it really isn't, but it was to understand the financial and non-financial side of the client in order to be able to give them advice. So, for example, I use something called the wills and estates intake form, which allows me to really, I call it, paint a picture of what the client is all about. Do you have something that you use, Vince, or do you find the same feedback from clients when you're asking them questions?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. And I think you have to take a holistic approach when you're, meeting with the client. First of all, it has to be a face-to-face meeting. I've had clients I've turned away where, for instance, they're spouses and only one spouse wants to come in to meet with me and give instructions on behalf of the other one. That's totally unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But the approach I take, first of all, is that I will send out, for clients that have internet access and email access, I will send out a checklist, ask them to print it out, fill it out as much as they can. And the nice thing about the checklist is that it really does trigger a lot of, it basically reminds clients or causes them to put their mind to certain issues. For example, how do they hold property, for example? Do they hold it jointly or as tenants in common with their spouse?
It's an inventory. It's a great communication tool.
It's a checklist.
Even if there's a couple, it's a great communication tool.
And also I have a wish list of documents I'd like them to bring in. The deed to their real estate. Again, do they own it? Because you'd be surprised where a lot of people think they own something, but it's actually maybe in the family business's name and not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see their life insurance policies and the designations there. More and more of my clients have been through divorces. So I'd like to see the separation agreement. I mean, those are critical because there could be continuing obligations. So, and also, I also send them a check, basically a list for them to maintain and keep current. And this is a list basically of all of their passwords and internet accounts. You'd be surprised how much more and more people have their assets stored on the internet, either through the cloud or Facebook or banking. And unfortunately in Ontario, we as of yet don't have any rules which give the executors the authority to require that provider to give access to that information. And so absent a court order, there's really no way to access those digital accounts. So one way to get around it, and may not be a perfect way, but is to give the executor those passwords and accounts that are held by the testator. At the actual meeting, I ask a lot of questions. Again, preparing wills is not just we're not scribes alone. It's more than just drafting documents.
If they see these, for want of a better word, these simple will kits, right, on the TV and everywhere, they just seem to think it's like a fill-in-the-blanks type exercise.
Well, the other problem with that, again, comes to, and this is where people make a lot of mistakes, is that they don't have it properly witnessed and signed.
Correct.
But the other thing, though, is you have to, people's estates or financial circumstances and personal circumstances are much more complex. So I go through the questions. I ask them, what's your educational background? What medication are you taking? Because I need to be satisfied that there's nothing affecting their ability to make a will.
Right.
Do you have assets in other countries? What's your citizenship status? If you're a U.S. citizen, there are a lot of consequences to that.
Right. That's a very specific.
And do you have disabled beneficiaries? More and more of my clients have either children or grandchildren who are reliant on provincial subsidy programs that have asset and income means tests. That if you cross that, i.e. if they receive an inheritance, they could be disinherited from that government program. So it's not just preparing the will saying, I appoint so-and-so as my executor and this is who I want to leave it to. It's not that simple. And there's also the other assets outside that can be passed on outside the will. For instance, life insurance policies and registered plans can designate beneficiaries. And they're not dealt with in the will altogether. But that has consequences too. And so
this is also an opportunity, once again, as a if you have an intake form and you're meeting with a lawyer personally to review all that information and have like a comprehensive plan and in case you've forgotten about it. And I agree with Vince on that, because I remember one time I was meeting with a client a few months ago, and it was an elderly gentleman who was looking to update his thing. His wife had passed away, and the son, who thought he knew everything about his parents' affairs, his father suddenly told him that with one of the online financial institutions, he had like $80,000 sitting there that nobody knew about. As an example of what you were talking about, that only came out because of people talking honestly and openly and directly about what their situation is. It's not an academic exercise or that lawyers are nosy or whatever, so that a proper advice can be given. And in that context, I guess, Vince, I find a lot of times that people are really afraid, you just mentioned, that they forget to do something and that the government is going to be involved in somehow dealing with their own assets. So what's your experience with that? Is that a wonderful experience or not? Or is it really a concern that's a bit exaggerated that people have, this fear that the government will become involved in all their personal affairs?
Well, the government, again, you know, I can tell you from my experience that the government agency, the public guardian trustee, is the last thing they want to do is take over estates. They are so overburdened.
You're saying they're overburdened. That means there are a lot of people.
There are a lot of
who
people
who are not properly organized in their own lifetime.
Well, and in fairness to them, they may never have had the capacity to prepare a will, and they may have come into an inheritance, and for whatever reason, you have to understand too that the public guardian trustee has jurisdiction over persons who are not capable of managing their property. So if they receive an inheritance, whether or not you have a will, if that property is held in trust for that person, there's an obligation to notify the public guardian trustee. If you have minor and unborn beneficiaries, there's the Children's Lawyer, Office of the Children's Lawyer, which is another provincial agency that addresses or deals with minor and unborn beneficiaries' interests. And so there's always going to be some scrutiny, especially where you have those beneficiaries receiving an asset or directly or in trust.
And so if monies, for example, are given to a grandchild, let's say even through a will, who's a minor, you have an obligation to advise the children's lawyer about
you
that?
You have an obligation to advise them. However, the ultimate control rests with the trustee. Again, right. And the other benefit of having a will is you put a minor clause in the will. Now, how do you feel about your grandchild receiving or child receiving an inheritance at 18?
Yeah, maybe not wonderful, because young people tend to be not as responsible with monies.
Well, in Ontario, that's the age of majority, as we know. It's not 21. It used to be. And so clients, for one or more reasons, may want to hold off on those distributions. Where you have minor beneficiaries, it's absolutely essential to have a provision to deal with holding the interests of any minor beneficiaries in trust. Because if they don't, those monies need to be paid into court. And then it's the children's lawyer that takes pretty well control, or has to be consulted with before any of those monies can be paid out or applied. And it's a much more cumbersome process. So that alone is worth making a will.
Now, you also just mentioned the question of what I would call a disabled beneficiary or somebody who has a particular handicap, and how we are seeing more and more perhaps children, grandchildren, and so on who have these ongoing disabilities. And again, also, I think maybe you can share experiences, but people are surprised or they're concerned that if they want to take care of that particular child or grandchild, but they don't want them to lose the benefits of certain rights that exist under the law in Ontario for people who have these handicaps, they're concerned that what will happen, again, is that if they leave them anything, the government's just going to step in and take it. You know, all these people from either the children's lawyer's office or the public trustee, they're going to come in and they're going to take their 2 cents and so on and so forth. And that they, how do you deal with a client who's worried about that? What can we do to help out maximize the benefit for someone who has some sort of a disadvantage or disability?
Well, first of all, if the assets are held in trust, if a proper trust is put in place in the will, the trust can provide for the payment and support of that beneficiary throughout that beneficiary's lifetime. But again, it always stays under the control of the executor, who becomes a trustee once the estate has been finalized. Can be either the executor or a special trustee, if you will, somebody that you can appoint somebody to administer the estate, pay the taxes and debts, and then once all the estate's been dealt with and distributed to the other beneficiaries, if there are any, you can appoint somebody to deal with that particular beneficiary's interest. Now, that beneficiary may be a beneficiary of a government program, and so you may want to preserve that beneficiary's interest or eligibility to receive those government benefits. And in Ontario, we have what's called the Ontario Disability Support Program. But that has, as I indicated earlier, asset and meet income tests. And so, for example, for a single individual, the asset limit for eligibility is $40,000.
And, and anything over $40,000 could be subject to the government, let's say, stepping in and controlling the situation.
Well, they wouldn't necessarily control the situation, but it would mean that their benefits could be cut off.
I see.
Deducted against the benefit. The benefits could be reduced by the amount of inheritance, and they may lose their eligibility under the program altogether, which means they would have to receive benefits from the estate. And once those benefits are exhausted, they would have to reapply. And if you've ever been through the process, it's not easy.
Hmm.
So there are ways to avoid that. It's not so much control. It's more of maintaining eligibility under the programs, but having the safety net of that inheritance in the background just in case to either supplement or replace. Because remember, these programs only run to a certain age. For the ODSP, Ontario Disability Support Program, that expires at once the beneficiary reaches the age of 65.
At which time they probably have an old age and Canada pension benefit that would kick in, perhaps?
I don't know how much they would have if they've never worked. They'd have very, very minimal benefits under
right,
those programs.
Right, so they'd be eligible maybe for social assistance otherwise.
Well, exactly. But it's a problem that you want to maintain any benefits that are available. But that's the key program, because those benefits are quite significant in terms of they could get up to $900 a month. There's drug benefit plans, there's transportation benefits, there's other disability support benefits, and you want to preserve those eligibility for those benefits.
So anybody who has a situation where they have a disadvantaged child or grandchild, it's really, really important to look at the whole picture that we were just talking about in terms of planning and certainly what a couple want to do. Now, what do you do, Vince, with, you mentioned about minor children and or minors in general obtaining things and so on and so forth under a will. What if you have somebody who comes in and they say, well, I remember I had an Italian gentleman one time many, many years ago who said to me, well, I have my will here and I'm just leaving everything to my kids. And I said to him, well, excuse me, you have your wife that you've been married to for 40 years. What are you doing with her? No, he said, the house belongs to me. And no, I'm just leaving everything for the kids because they're there. That's going to get it. So what happens in a situation like that? I mean, we just talked much earlier in the program about testamentary freedom. So if I, like this gentleman I mentioned, if he wants me to do a will, even though I'm maybe trying to encourage him to deal with the fact that he's married and he's been married for a long time and she may not have anything. Or, I mean, how do you deal with a situation like that when you, I mean, does the spouse have any rights at all? That what happens in that kind of a situation?
Well, absent what's called a domestic agreement, which is, could be a marriage contract or separation agreement or cohabitation.
Which we don't see very much still, even though today it's not as common as one might imagine?
Not unless they've been through it once already. Then right. They're a little bit more gun-shy.
A little bit more
And they usually take my advice at that point, or they've already taken it.
I mean, in Ontario, yes, we do have testamentary freedom, but it is tempered by family law, matrimonial law, if you will, and dependency support claims. So we talk about family law. In Ontario, marriage is seen as a partnership.
Right, economic partnership.
Economic partnership. And so on the breakdown...
And Vince, that's just for our listeners, because I think this question has been asked about 1,000 times during my 39-year legal career. And common law spouses, they don't have the same rights as married people, right? I mean, as a real broad general principle...
In Ontario, they don't have what would be called statutory rights with respect to the division of property, mm-hmm. Although there is a body of law that's developing, which we call equity, if you will. Mm-hmm. And basically, the term used is unjust enrichment, if you will.
Right. Something where, seems to be really, really unfair.
Where the unmarried spouse, a classic example, a common law couple, you know, the wife has a successful business, the husband has been contributing to it, but never received a share of the business and gave up other career opportunities. And if that spouse is left with nothing, then he will probably have a claim for either an unjust restitution, which is a monetary compensation, or what's called a proprietary interest. That is, the court can basically impose what's called a constructive trust and say, you didn't leave your spouse anything, but really he's entitled to 30% of the business.
So but getting married, you really create, I guess you cross that threshold, right?
Well, that can be in addition too. Yeah. You know, that doesn't preclude what are called claims for unjust enrichment. When the couple is married, there's an equalization payment regime, which, putting it very simply, because it's a complicated process, basically, the spouses are entitled to divide the property that they've accumulated during marriage equally between them.
So that's not just in the matter of a separation and divorce. That would also be on death, correct?
Exactly.
So that gentleman I told you about who told me he didn't want to leave his wife anything, and everything goes to the kids. So if he passes away tomorrow, what can that spouse do that was left nothing under the will?
You know, the spouse can make an equalization claim against the estate, and that would not be a claim for a gift. That would be a debt. She would basically stand in the place of a creditor. So the spouse would be entitled to a court order. There would be a calculation of the property owned by the deceased spouse and the surviving spouse. There'd be comparison. There'd be, again, in essence, an equalization, an order made for an equalization claim by the estate to the spouse, which would take priority over the terms of the will. In addition to that, the spouse could have what's called a dependency claim. So if the spouse, notwithstanding receiving those assets, still could maintain a certain standard of living, and if the estate could afford to pay for it, the estate would also be required to pay a dependency or support payments to the surviving spouse, which either could be a lump sum or payments over a period of time. So, yes, there is testamentary freedom, but there's an asterisk next to that.
Right, and it's good that people know that in terms of how they deal with it. I used the example of an elderly Italian gentleman I dealt with, but more and more, I think, as clients, we see people of other faiths, in particular, perhaps, Islamic faith and Sharia law, and certainly when you have mixed marriages that go on quite a bit today, and it's a reality of our society here in Canada, I guess it would be some of those same old issues, right? Because traditionally speaking, I remember even 35 years ago in traditional Chinese society, some of my clients would leave their daughters nothing, for example. They would only leave their sons. But if they were more modern, they would leave two parts to their sons and one part to their daughter, let's say, in the regime. So we do have, whether we agree with it or not, we have these different influences that are there. And so some people think, well, if under my particular religion or whatever, my personal viewpoint, I'm not going to be able to do exactly what I want to do. Is that right? Or what I feel is appropriate?
Well, the best advice I can give to the client is have a domestic agreement entered into with the spouse that reflects those rules. Again, even with the domestic agreement, the courts have ultimate jurisdiction. You know, if they see it as being unequitable or unfair, they can overturn the provisions. But at least you have something to fall back on. If the spouses each received their own independent legal advice, they weren't, you know, they had adequate time, ideally before the marriage, to obtain that legal advice and agree to sign the agreement, then at least you have something that could be agreed to that is reflective to either their cultural or religious norms.
Now, Vince, you mentioned something, and we all know that even though we are the voice of Catholic radio here in Canada, we know realistically that there are large numbers of, you know, in Catholics, really no different probably than the general population, one in three perhaps, that will see divorce. And so therefore, whether you are that individual or you are a parent or grandparent of a child or grandchild that will go through that, it's something that's become so often so common. We know, unfortunately, we live in that kind of a society. And so oftentimes what we see, of course, is the marriages break down for any number of reasons. And sometimes there's children and grandchildren who are adversely affected. And of course, people reestablish relationships and become remarried. So, and you mentioned a marriage contract, we'll call it. I think we call it a domestic contract. And it's something because in a lot of European countries in particular, there's something called it's almost a statement that if you choose when you get married, you can basically, what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. There seems to be that legal tradition. And of course, and I'm sure other clients that we've had who come maybe from different faiths and other cultures were actually, like the old days, even back in Italy, women were sort of put to the side and the men inherited and so on and so forth. So we see that situation, but now with the question of remarriage and so on in particular, especially if there are children involved, because I think you and I would both see relationships of people getting married who maybe have another family, a child or two that they're bringing into the relationship. So what do you say to people like that who even are listening to us today or have a family dynamic where that's the case? Is it perhaps even more advisable to have what I call a marriage contract? And how will that hook into a will type situation?
Well, I think that obviously behooves the client to have some type of agreement in place because, and again, it depends on the family dynamics, because where you have blended families, where you have children from other relationships involved, whether or not they're adopted, they do have certain rights of child support from the parent that's able to pay. There's an actual table of child support that the courts follow. And so where the child has been treated or considered or treated as a child of the parent or the new spouse, if you will, there's certain rights which can't be contracted out of, although you can, as between the spouses, I believe, allocate responsibility. But ultimately, the second parent, even if they've treated that child as their own, if they've been in a relationship of permanence with the parent, then they can actually they will be responsible for supporting that child. So again, there is the spousal rights that arise that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. With the second spouse. And so an agreement needs to be put into place in order to deal with how the assets are going to be divided, and perhaps more so in the second marriage, where the spouses actually have something to lose. Because first right. marriage, usually they're coming in with nothing. So right. marriage is a partnership. That makes sense. They're mm-hmm. building a life together. In a second marriage, they may have children from other relationships.
They may have other
built
assets.
Up their assets. Yeah. And so they can understand what's mine is yours is yours. So,
well, that's good. So, and I guess just in that similar line, as we're leading to the end of our session today. So, you know, in European law, if you have a child, even let's say you're married, but you have another child and you're the father or the mother of that child, they have rights to inherit because they have a forced heirship regime. Is that the case here in Ontario or not really? I mean, you may have a right to support the child, but does the child automatically have a right to inherit?
If they're not your child, or even if they are your child, there's no forced inheritance, although they can, again, claim support. And so it's not that we have forced heirship rules, but if a child has been left out and they feel that, you know, it was unjust, either if they may be entitled to support if they're a minor child or in university, or they may argue that the will is not valid, which is what they usually argue. And so if that happens, then you're back to the laws of intestacy. And if
the
it's
the importance, certain, again, of having a will and addressing all those situations.
And making sure you have a lawyer who's vetted the client to ensure that they have the capacity, has the notes to support that. So you have a valid
will. So it'll be upheld. Exactly. Well, that's great. Vince, I want to thank you very much today for your input. It's been a lot of information. I think all of our listeners, their heads are spinning now listening to two lawyers talking for an hour. But the important thing, knowledge is power, and we want people to become aware of things, understand things, and, of course, act in their own best interest and the best interest of their family. Thanks once again, Vince, for all your input today. And we'll go back into the studio to Nick to take it away.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.